more joy and laughter, more than we'll ever need, living more fearlessly, losing all the pain and misery. I hope. We hear a lot these days in Unitarian Universalist circles, at least, about faith in action. And most of the time, people are talking about advocacy and justice work. But there is another kind of faith in action. And I think those stories we heard at the beginning of the service were two illustrations, Abraham and Sarah and Amanda Eller. One is timeless and biblical, and the other is recent and factual. They are stories about decisions to defy what seems obviously true and realistic and predictable. And those decisions were the thing on which everything turned. The thing that changed everything was their choice. They were very different decisions, and they were the same decision: to live and to believe in life and take action that supports that belief. To take the next step beyond hopelessness. A step beyond hopelessness into hope and risk. Something in us yearns for life, for what is life-giving in every way. Something in us pulls us towards that good and towards participating in and upholding that good, because good is what is life-giving. You may remember that from last week. And we know that it's possible, that even sometimes against all odds, something better is possible, and so we keep hoping and acting on the hope. Right? Hope isn't the action. It's not the be-all and end-all. Hope is the foundation. Hope pushes us to do. And it creates this funny kind of evolution, because what it pushes us to do then becomes the justification for hope in the first place. All this is a lot of theology. But it's theology that matters, because we are living in a thrilling and demoralizing time. We have so much possibility before us. We have new capacities for justice and compassion, new capacities for saving the earth, and so much selfishness and ignorance and short-sightedness standing between us and the goodness that is possible. Well, frankly, the goodness is more than possible. Let's be real and say it is imperative. We cannot live on this planet if we turn it into a husk. And we cannot have peace if we victimize each other. And that is all just basic math. But basic as that math is, here is a little more. We have known for a while that we needed to do better by the planet. We didn't always know how much was riding on it, but we knew a lot. And so far, we have done pitiably little, as we all know. And likewise, the issues of victimizing each other, race and class and heritage and religion, and all the ways humankind has timelessly drawn these lines between us and them to further our own egos and status at the expense of whoever we define as other. So while the challenges before us are very clear, they are also just this side of eternal. What in the world gives us the chutzpah to think? Then we can make the differences that need to be made. What in the world makes us think that we might have more love, more joy, and laughter? Live more fearlessly, finally lose, all the pain and misery. Many factors contribute to that answer, and the only one I want to talk to you about today is hope. There is so little of it in the world right now. Each day floods us with stories of outrage and tragedy, from the smallest and most intimate to the greatest and most national or international, ubiquitous, unavoidable, mind-blowing, and heartbreaking. It's not really a surprise to learn that birth rates in the last few years in this country are the lowest that they have been in many decades. Analysts tell us that this is, check this out, a barometer of despair. When people don't have babies, it's because the world doesn't feel like one that they want to raise a family in. And this is part of the reality that hope has to respond to. Because if hope cannot get real, it is not worth wasting our time on. Not even in this sermon. And not in our daily living. Back in 2000, when I relocated to take only my second solo ministry, it was in the Washington, D.C. area, and I had no idea what was ahead of me. I had no idea of the rich and relevant and inspiring journey that was ahead of me serving a congregation there for many years. And I had no idea that a year from then, I would wake up one morning to watch the Twin Towers collapse on television, to watch the Pentagon burn from the roof of my DC apartment building, to learn late that night that a family tied to my church had died in the plane that hit the Pentagon, including two very young and wonderful daughters. I didn't know that one of my parishioners would be prey to the anthrax attacks on our government that quickly followed 9/11. Remember those? She opened mail in Tom Daschle's office, and she survived. And I didn't know that just a year after that, the DC snipers, just a year after that, exactly, the DC snipers would kill half their victims in Silver Spring, the same town as my congregation. And I didn't know that the day after the DC snipers were caught, Al-Qaeda operatives would shoot to death a parishioner's father who was working in Jordan, machine gunning him down in front of his home as he was leaving for work, where he was found by his wife. He was a smart and good man. He was an American, and he was a supporter of Palestinian rights, which at the time was the reason Al-Qaeda was giving for their attacks, Palestinian rights. He was a man who worked in politics for peace and for people's empowerment his whole life. I had no idea any of that was coming. And of course, it didn't all come only to me, but it did also come to me. And once I was in that turbulent, terrible time, I also had no idea how to hold it all, how to walk with and lead my people through all this destruction and death and anguish and chaos without crumbling myself. This was not what I expected when I went into ministry. And it was not what I expected when I took that congregation on the outskirts of DC. And that was fair. It wasn't what I thought I had signed up for. Right? That's fair. But you know what? That didn't matter. That didn't matter then, and it doesn't matter now, because that is life. We don't always get to pick our battles. Sometimes we do, and that helps. At least then, the struggle is our choice. But so often, the struggle is not our choice. It comes upon us whether we're ready or not, whether we want it or not, whether we're prepared or suited or skilled or informed, whether we have any sense of what the heck we ought to be doing or not. And every time that happens, every time the struggle comes upon us, we don't get to choose whether. We only get to choose how. We don't get to choose whether we will respond. We only get to choose how. It's the same point you've heard in all of the readings today. Pope Francis, who says that hope requires we do not dwell in the past. We have got to steel ourselves and look forward. W.E.B. Du Bois's beautiful prayer that we be and stay absolutely resolute, and that out of all that is wrong may come all that is good. The Jewish teachings that life is a process of engagement and commitment, considering always not just what the world is, but what it should be, and what we not can, but must do with our own living to co-create that better world that depends on us for its making. And a passage you haven't heard yet, you're going to hear it shortly, by the Egyptian-American Muslim writer Yasmin Mogahed. And in it, it's so beautiful. In it, she reminds us that it is possible, not just possible, but essential to go forward towards the sacred. Go forward towards the sacred. Even when that going forward is a progress that carries pain and hardship throughout the journey. Western society has offered itself an onward and upward narrative for a long time. It has perceived history and reality with that lens, even when it's taken a lot of angling of the lens sometimes to make it work. And our religion has done the same thing. At another painful and despairing time in our nation's history, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. preached that even when evil seems preeminent and goodness seems beaten and crucified, he said, still, good will rise again. And the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And Dr. King was quoting one of our great Unitarian ministers, Reverend Theodore Parker, this fiery 18th century preacher and abolitionist who first created that phrase about the arc of the universe with this long lens, right, of resilience and justification of hope. Nowadays, not everyone believes that our direction is always onward and upward. The arc just isn't that clean. And while its long line over millennia has arguably bent in the direction of betterment and justice overall, this far, the more our mortal powers grow, the more the whole endpoint of that arc can be prey to the whims of a few. Maybe a very few. There's so much wrong with our world and with our nation and with many of our leaders and many of our institutions and many of our communities and with, let's not forget, our own selves, right? With all our inherent racism and sexism and classism, all those isms that we are wrestling so hard to free ourselves of. Usually with uneven success. They are deep-rooted, and they've been part of us so long. It's going to be a long haul, this journey of being better to each other and to our planet, and yes, to ourselves. And as we all know, windows for saving everything, are closing all the time. There's the kind of cosmic claustrophobia creeping up on us as we begin to wonder whether we really are trapped in here, in all this, and whether we can really, really find our way out. Of course, this is where hope comes in. But what does that really mean? Sometimes we refer to hope as if it just comes. And sometimes it does. Like a warm, sunny day after a remarkably bleak time of weather. It lifts our spirits all the more, and it reminds us of the goodness that is simply is in the world. Goodness that we cannot compel, and we have no responsibility for whatsoever, and what a relief that is. But hope that comes so easily can also leave us just as easily. With the next bleak day, or dire discovery, or outrageous news cycle. In which case, what justifies hope at all? Not the ephemeral hope that flits in and out, lifting us and letting us fall, but a stronger, better, realer hope that the world, society, we can actually become different, that we can make a difference, not just a difference, but enough of a difference. Reverend Dr. Miguel de la Torre teaches at the Iliff School of Theology in Colorado, and he studies how religion intersects with class and race and gender oppression, and he also focuses on issues of immigrant justice, about which he has extensive and ongoing knowledge. So as a theologian, he does not pussyfoot around. And this is most evident in his theology of hopelessness. Where most of us are always looking for hope, Reverend Dr. De La Torre has abandoned it. He has not just abandoned hope, he has embraced hopelessness. He has embraced hopelessness because he believes that when we cling to hope and hopefulness, this brings with it a kind of complacency. When we look at the bright side or content ourselves with the belief that things always work out in the end, all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. We let ourselves off the hook, and we let down all those whose lives are hanging in the balance right then. Instead, Reverend Dr. De La Torre believes it is only when hope dies that action begins. It is only when hope dies that action begins. It is only when, if we wake up and realize that all will not be well, if we do not get in the game, and not just in the game, that's not enough anymore, if we don't change the game before it's too late, then we really begin to make a difference. I am not asking you to give up all hope. I think of Dr. De La Torre's, and we've spoken about this a couple times. I love his idea of embracing hopelessness, and I think it's important. And I think it is the other side of a coin that I hold on to and am offering you today. The other way to look at this is that, yes, people say there's always hope. And I think that's largely true. But not because hope is always out there dangling like a light bulb or a star that you just need to look around until you see. In my experience, hope doesn't work that way at all. In my experience, the hope that really matters is not the hope you look around for. It is the hope you look inside for. It is hope that is not about wishing, because you cannot change the things that have already happened. It is hope that is about strength. It is hope that is about a refusal to accept what is unacceptable, a refusal to allow what is reprehensible, a refusal to ignore what is deathly. That kind of hope may be a wellspring in you already, or you may have to do some deep digging and discernment to find it. You may have to excavate. And it may take work and time. And I say this because that is what I have had to learn to do. That is what I didn't have when I needed it already as a wellspring in me. Life and work have repeatedly required me to grow and dig in order to be equal to the times and the places that I have found myself in. But the work of finding that kind of dogged hope does not let you down. In fact, it makes you bigger and more courageous and more of a risk taker and more capable. All of that is in every one of us, and it is only when we work for it that we begin to find it. Hope that is grounded not in complacency, but in strength. Not in certainty, but in possibility. And understanding not that everything will be fine, but that there is something for us to do and that we can do it. And so we will do it. If we can do something, then we must do something. And so we will do something. And if we all get on that train, things change. And that is what justifies hope. When we all get on a train, things change. And that is what justifies hope. Not eternal optimism, but developed strength. Not certainty, but possibility. That is the virtue of Pope Francis's unlocked heart. And that is Du Bois's resolution to persist in good work. And that is Yasmin Mogahed's Haji, who will not be deterred by pain and hardship. That is it. And we have all already known struggle in life. And we will encounter more struggles and possibilities beyond all expectation. And our options will never be whether, but only how. Choose deep. Choose strong. Choose compassion. Choose risk. Choose the deep work of hope that is built on strength. I am not saying this because it sounds good. I am saying this because history shows us that the most important victories have been won by people who doubled down on hope. Not ignorant or naive. They were informed and committed, and they doubled down on hope against all odds, and they acted in ways that were not realistic, and they won miracles. All I have suffered, all I have accomplished, all I have mourned, and all I have exalted in, all of it has taught me to give everything I have to hope built on strength. Hope built on strength will bless you. And then you will bless the world. Amen.